What's up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson. My guest today is the, I hope I'm saying this right, the Marie Sklodowska-Curie Fellow at the Center for War Studies at the University of Southern Denmark, which means we're the time difference could not be more stark, but I think it will be worth it. Be worth it for everybody. She's co-edited two volumes on international diplomacy, and she's leading an EU-funded project on empathy and international security, which makes sense because she has this terrific journal article out that we're going to talk about that's in the Journal of Strategic Studies about empathy and strategy. It's a fascinating read. And so my guest coming at you from Europe is none other than Dr. Claire York. How are you doing, Claire?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here tonight, your morning, but it's great to see you.
Yeah, this time thing is nuts. You're very interesting because you come from a place of like hybrid policy and scholarship, which is not unlike where I come from, except that you're way more familiar with the European context than I am. And I was kind of a slave to the national security state in the US, obviously. And it's not the same in Europe, the policy community. I mean, it's less militarist at a minimum, the vibe, or it was. So like, I'm kind of curious just to start out, even though this is not your journal article, what were security people, like people doing security policy in Europe? How were they occupying their time before the Trump years?
That's a great question. So I spent most of my professional career in policy in Britain. So it's obviously bridging that American-Europe divide a little bit. And there is this kind of very strong sense in London, at least, of the special relationship and the importance of America. But there's also different concerns because obviously we have far more borders. There's also the importance of diplomacy with European neighbors. Before Trump came in, Britain was in the EU and the EU was having a moment of dealing with the refugee crisis, of helping people on the borders. You obviously had the conflict and war in Syria and Libya and other parts of the Middle East and North African region. And then obviously the tensions as well that we're now seeing in Ukraine. The conflict now was obviously going on before this in various different forms and tensions. And so it was much more European centered, much more centered on how the allies within the Union would work together. But also you get a really eclectic community of security professionals. At least in London, we'd have a lot of contact with people who were in defense and security, but also in NGOs and development and foreign policy and diplomacy from around the world. So you get this very eclectic space.
Yeah, that's my sense of it, even though I was like never really part of it. Before we get into the review essay, I was wondering if you could explain your background a bit and like how your prior research or your prior policy exposure kind of led you to this topic.
Yeah. So I actually started as a language student at university because I just loved that ability to travel and to speak with different people from different countries, which I think underpins a lot of the work I do now on empathy and trying to understand how different people experience the world. So I ran the parliamentary office of a member of one of the opposition benches and working on defense. So I was doing that within Parliament and the House of Commons, which was fascinating. And you get a real exposure to the challenges of legislation and politics and the complexities of that space. And after that, I then went on to manage the International Security Research Department at Chatham House. So again, doing this very broad range of security topics, terrorism, nuclear weapons, human security, drugs and organized crime, this real diverse and interesting mix, and working with some brilliant people there. And that gave me that exposure to policy and the awareness of how much expertise there is out there and how much curiosity about the world. And I just kept feeling that there was this gap between what lots of people cared about and what they knew and how policy was being implemented. That kind of the gap. How is it that there's all this knowledge and curiosity and understanding, but we don't always see it translated into maybe more nuanced policies, especially in security? Or why do we not maybe see some of the different approaches to some of the challenges? There's a lot of kind of assumptions that we don't question. But I also found that there's a lot of the literature on empathy. When I went to do my doctorate at King's College London, a lot of the research on empathy assumes that it's something you insert into the process, whereas I found that actually it's there. There's a lot of people who, as I said, try to understand the world better, have this real curiosity and knowledge of different countries and cultures and people. So what are the obstacles? So that's really why my focus is on the politics of empathy. So the gaps, the systems, the structures that make it harder to have more empathy within policy and strategy, the personalities, the mentalities, and what all of that means. So then I did the PhD in empathy and diplomacy, and then a postdoc at Yale, where I developed that. And then now I'm in Denmark working on this Marie Sklodowska-Curie Fellowship.
Nice. Well, I'm jealous. It looks like a very lovely place. What is this EU-funded project on empathy? Like, are there provisional research questions or arguments? I mean, I guess mostly I'm curious about all of it, but I'm curious also like what the EU's interest in it is, because this is the kind of thing that I imagine would have a hard time getting funded in the US, even though it's like evidently an important topic. I think, I mean, that's why you're here, right?
So I'm interested in what role can empathy play and does empathy play in international security? And also, how can we use empathy as a lens and a practice and a mindset to try and find new, innovative, creative solutions to some of the challenges that we're facing? And if we look over the past few years, and when I was writing the application in the years preceding that, we've had the pandemic, we've had conflicts, we've also had a lot of movements on climate, on race, on gender that have really tried to say and highlight this fact that we're not listening to enough people. And in order to find the solutions collectively and collaboratively, we have to be expanding the dialogue and recognizing that there isn't just one way of experiencing the world. So I look through the project at different ways in which empathy has played a role historically and in contemporary leadership and in contemporary challenges, and where there have been gaps, what the cost of those gaps have been, and what some of the lessons that have been learned might be, and what they might hold and offer for the future.
So it makes sense how this journal article came about. I'm always trying to understand, like, where do these research outputs come from? Like, you know, there's an origin story that I'm always trying to get at. And so this makes sense now. Okay, so there are a handful of concepts that I've thought for a while are important in doing strategy well and making good strategic choices over time. And there are concepts that everyone talks about, and especially in like strategic studies or practice of strategy, like risk and proportionality and prioritization and coordination. But I mean, there are concepts that nobody really ever talks about either, but that are also important. Some of these are like tempo and valence, which is really capacious. And then related is empathy. And it seems counterintuitive maybe that empathy would be important to strategy, because strategy is very, you say this in the article actually, like it's very instrumentalist. It's this means ends vocation. And you stress that empathy is like very not one dimensional. It's not necessarily instrumentalist. I guess to start, what do you have, like a concise working definition of empathy?
Yes, I do. And there's also, there's empathy in the context of strategy and then strategic empathy. And I separate them out.
I want to talk about that too, yeah. I have concerns.
I want to hear them. And so I think a working definition of empathy itself is an attempt to understand the perspectives, mindset, concepts, context, feelings, history, and experiences of others. And it's never going to be definitive. You cannot accurately understand how another views the world, but it's that effort. And built into it is also this dimension of self-reflection, that you understand that empathy is iterative. So what you learn has a bearing on how you think about a problem and how you think about your role in that problem or in that context and that situation, and an awareness of how you are experienced by the world, at least in this space. Because when we use it in diplomacy or in strategy, it's in order to try to understand how you might have a certain effect on the world. And in order to do that well, you have to understand how you're experienced as well by the world. And Sun Tzu obviously did not use the word empathy, but he speaks about this idea of know the enemy and know yourself. Mm-hmm. And it's that sense of understand where they're coming from, but also know what it is you're saying and doing and the implications of that, which is maybe not as short as you'd wanted it to be. I added a lot on there.
Yeah. No, it was a hard question to answer, actually, because there's a lot in it inherently. It's kind of, I mean, do you see something in like standpoint theory that like if you embrace the ontology of standpoints, you're more likely to be empathetic or something like that? Is there anything in that?
I think it's always helpful to take a different standpoint and to see these different perspectives of the world. One of the elements that I emphasize with empathy is that it puts emotions far more in the equation. How do people feel? And what do they give meaning to? So it isn't just an objective assessment of facts and an analysis of a situation, but it's also where do people give meaning and why? And so it's also more than culture, but this emotional lens, I think, is an important dimension of it. It shouldn't just be purely analytical. So we should be thinking about people within it.
Yeah. So there's an emotional layer on something like intersectionality, where you have these experiences or this particular context that shapes you or informs you, but empathy, and that has to be part of the picture, but it's insufficient because that doesn't necessarily program what your emotional register is going to be. Is that?
I think if we understand what emotions people attach to things, what are they proud of? What makes them feel humiliated? What makes them feel shame? What makes them feel joy or pride or anger? You then understand kind of how might they respond to certain initiatives or certain overtures. Mm-hmm. Do we understand that? It may be intended in one way, but will it feel that way to the people who are receiving it? And so being far more receptive to emotions and not seeing them as purely irrational and unquantifiable, but an essential and integral part of the human experience.
Do you think it's useful or helpful to detach empathy and compassion? Like, is that going on the wrong path, or is that a smart appropriation?
Am I allowed to say yes and no?
So nuance all you want.
I really like the nuance. So they can be linked, obviously, and empathy can lead to greater compassion. Mm-hmm. But compassion, the way we use it, is more equated with kindness. It has this pro-social idea that you are going to help someone, you're going to help alleviate their suffering, you're going to do something to rectify their situation. Mm-hmm. And empathy can be more analytical. As much as I said, it should be attuned to emotions and how different people experience the world, it can be slightly detached. You're not compelled to act in a certain way because of what you gain. And especially when we're talking about diplomacy or strategy, you're dealing with such a range of different perspectives that may be at odds. It's impossible to maybe feel compassion for everyone at the same time. So we can use empathy to gain insights and perspectives, but I would keep them separate, but acknowledge that they are connected in some ways. There are certain progressions that lead you more to compassion than empathy.
Okay. You had an anecdote about the Vietnam War and I think Afghanistan. I thought it was just helpful to illustrate how empathy is impactful or whatever for people whose minds are all on strategy all the time. Can you kind of like share what that was?
Yeah. So I think one of the accessible books on the power of empathy is The Fog of War by Blyton Lang and obviously the Secretary of Defense, McNamara. Yeah. It puts empathy as the first lesson that McNamara learned from his time in office. But he's also got throughout his other book in retrospect about Vietnam, this real importance about we didn't understand the Vietnamese. We didn't understand their motivations. We didn't know what they were fighting for. We projected this communist lens that was very prevalent at that time in America onto them. And if we'd understood that they were actually fighting for liberation and they were fighting for freedom, we might have approached it very differently and it wouldn't have lasted so long. It wouldn't have cost so many lives on all sides and so much money and investment and resources. And what I think is really interesting when I was looking through the archives on the China visit that Henry Kissinger did in kind of 1972, talking to the Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai. And Zhou Enlai is saying, the Americans don't understand that they're fighting for the same reason that you fought the British. And if you understood that, you'd maybe approach this very differently. So there was this kind of sense that we haven't, that the Americans hadn't understood what the Vietnamese were trying to do.
Shocking. Yeah. Okay, so you have a section especially that I thought was helpful on the security dilemma. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the role of empathy in strategic interaction with that? That is like the premier example in my mind.
Yeah, and there's some great work on this by people like Nicholas Wheeler and Ken Booth, who write specifically about this idea of the security dilemma sensibility. And Joshua Baker is another one who's written about it in the context of Iran. And so the security dilemma is where, for those who aren't familiar with it, where you have this escalation of tensions because you don't understand the other side. And so you end up caught in this spiral of increasingly escalatory measures because you interpret the other side as defending themselves or arming themselves, whereas they see themselves as defending themselves against you. And this misperception and the false assumptions and the enemy images within that then become very hard to break. And so by using what they term the security dilemma sensibility, it's a way of saying, okay, well, why are they feeling threatened? Why are they arming themselves more? What is it that maybe we're doing that is leading them to these increasingly defensive measures that look to us quite antagonistic and aggressive? And so again, it speaks to that idea that empathy is reflexive. It makes you reflect on how you're experienced by the world and others.
Yeah. One of my concerns or like working theories for American pathologies is like a distinct lack of empathy when it comes to anything that we might label like great power politics or geopolitics. Like when we enter a certain mode of viewing the world and the policy implications that like all follow from entering that idiom or that semantic refuge, like there's this psychological baggage that we carry. I don't want to psychologize us necessarily, but there's some kind of baggage that like prevents us from seeing the other side in a meaningful way. Like how might we be culpable in the things that we don't like that are happening that the other side is doing because we're not tuned in at all to like their emotional register or what their concerns are. And that might be a good pivot point for this whole strategic empathy question. So the phrase has entered into like military parlance, and I have some critical thoughts about it, but what is it, first of all, and like what do you see as like limiting about it or wrong about it?
So strategic empathy, it has quite long roots, actually. You can see people like Ralph K. White using it in the 1960s, but he uses realistic empathy, but they seem to be very similar in what their intentions are, as a way to say we need to understand the Soviet Union because we're making errors because we don't understand them, and we need to understand Saddam Hussein in one of his later articles because we don't understand how he's going to act. And so strategic empathy now has become a way to talk about how to understand really your enemies and your adversaries. How might they be thinking as a way to then better defeat or
kill them,
triumph
better.
Over them? How do you get around the challenges that they're presenting, and how are you able to maintain the upper hand and make sure you're not losing out? So there's some really good pieces on this, and people like Matt Waldman have written about it in the context of Afghanistan, which I think is really useful because he says, The Americans and the allies didn't understand the Taliban. They didn't understand the dynamics. They didn't understand their willingness to fight. They didn't understand their capacity for patience. And also the kind of the ways in which power was organized in the country and how you needed to win over certain people and you needed to get certain things on side. So it's strategic empathy is seen as a way to realize strategic objectives through a better understanding of an adversary. The problem with it is it can then be this very instrumental way of doing empathy that then is blinded to one's own role in a conflict. And it's interesting because people like H.R. McMaster, General H.R. McMaster, who's written on strategic empathy, and he's very much an advocate of this idea of we need to understand the Chinese and the Iranians, which is, I think, important. And also he highlights this idea of strategic narcissism and hubris and how that can get in the way of empathy, which is something you see throughout the literature. But one of my challenges with it is that it does become too instrumental. It becomes another way of dominating or another way of coercing people to do things your way, and that your ability and capacity for self-reflection is limited. It doesn't really lead to an adaptation of how you actually behave or change your policy.
Yeah.
I don't know what you're doing,
though. Yeah, no, that's great. There was a time pre-McMaster, pre-Trump, where I used to use the term strategic empathy sometimes, but then it kind of got co-opted by people like McMaster. And I heard him say that, if I was in China's shoes, I'd want revenge for a century of humiliation and I'd want to conquer the globe. What's going on there when you say that? You, as in he, McMaster, is calling that strategic empathy. But that's not empathy. That's a rhetorical trick where you smuggle in assumptions about China having maximalist ambitions and worst case intentions, you know? And so the McMaster style usage of strategic empathy is this example of it to me, how superficial engagement with empathy as a concept can take you down the wrong kind of path. Or like you said something about domination, a legitimating tool in order to support ends that are anti-empathetic, anti-just in a sense.
Yeah, and it can be a projection. That's the problem. If you can't actually understand how the enemy thinks, you're projecting it. And the problem is it's in the thick of war or in the aftermath of a very traumatic event, such as something like 9/11, where you really have had this huge shock and this tragedy and this horrific event happen to your country and your people. It's very hard to then see the other side in a way that might have some more nuance to really know what is going on here. How do you extrapolate out the genuine threat and the bigger context and the history and what's going on? Yeah, I think it's good that we're talking about it in this space. Another good book on this is Zachary Shaw, How to Think Like the Enemy. There are people who are writing, but again, my concern is that it does become about a projection and not really about a real understanding about the iterative, interactive dimensions that should be a part of empathy and the emotions. How does China feel? Mm-hmm. As much as that's very hard to really know in any quantifiable way, it's, I think, an important thing.
I agree with the idea. I suppose it's a good thing that military people would try to reach out to embrace empathy for even instrumental reasons, but the way you do it clearly matters. And the idea that empathy can be an antidote to hubris, it sounds like you agree with that. I think I agree with that too. It's just that's not how it's working when they're doing the strategic empathy thing. If you're using the concept to sustain or to optimize a strategy of primacy or of global empire or of preventive war, well, those are all choices that reflect hubris. So it's not an antidote to hubris in that instance. I don't know. I mean, I guess you can't control an idea. You know, if you were to popularize empathy in the strategic community, and then the strategic community doubles down on strategic empathy as it currently stands, well, that would be a problem, I suppose.
Yeah, I think part of it is this mindset that has really dominated many decades now, that there is a better way of doing things, which is predominantly Western and liberal. And that then there are the others, and they will come around to this mindset in time. And I think it denies the plurality of approaches, but also it hinders that reflection. How are we seen mm-hmm. by the world? And I think especially that's been what's interesting, for example, when you have President Trump in power, people say, oh, maybe we're not quite what we thought. We didn't expect this to happen. Maybe we're not seen in the same way around the world when you have world leaders laughing at your president at international gatherings. It undermines that idea and that image that America has of itself. And it's hard. And that's one of the things I say with empathy, is it's not comfortable, because you have to countenance the fact that there are different ways of viewing the world, and they may be at odds with how you view it.
Yeah. Doing things that would fall under the connotation of being soft, not hard, are in fact quite difficult. Hard as in difficult, which is why they don't often happen in the hard-boiled American context. You talk a lot about how empathy has psychological roots and micro foundations and individual behavior. And that's a good starting point, I suppose. But you also point out that person-grounded empathy, individualized empathy, well, that's the impact of that is going to be limited to the reach of that person. And it made me wonder if empathy can be institutionalized. Your work kind of presumes that it can. And so I want to get you on wax affirming whether that's the case, but also like if it can be institutionalized, what would that look like?
Yeah. And I have a chapter on this in my book that's going to come out at some point in the next year on kind of what it looks like in diplomacy and institutional level. And I do argue that it can be, because you're right, it normally has this interpersonal dimension, but actually when we're talking about it in the context of diplomacy or strategy, you need multiple people to adopt these different mindsets and cultures. So when I think of empathy being institutionalized or in a group level, I think about organizational cultures and also the ways in which organizations prioritize and value different forms of knowledge. So is it an organization that values curiosity? Does it value understanding? Does it encourage people to come and say, look, I know this is the dominant mindset and the model and the thinking right now, but I've been spending time out on the ground in this country and this is not aligning with what our ideas are saying. How about we think about this differently? And having that kind of adaptability and the flexibility to think differently about a problem, that may not necessarily be empathy. I talk about it in terms of steps, that there's elements that may not be full on empathy, but that they constitute steps towards empathy, if that makes sense. So curiosity, encountering different perspectives, also challenging traditional hierarchies. And this is one of the challenges you have in institutions, and especially in the military, is you have very senior people at the top. And sometimes it can be hard to get them to listen to those who are lowered down in levels of rank and seniority because they're seen as junior, but actually those people bring new knowledge. They bring different perspectives. They have access to worldviews that maybe you're more disconnected from once you've been in an organization for 20, 30 years. So how do you maybe break down that hierarchy, encourage challenge functions, and also expand the dialogue? Who is involved in the space determining policy and determining the nature of the challenge that we face? And that's one of the things we see right now, for example, with climate change that I think is really encouraging. We're seeing a lot of indigenous groups and voices. We're seeing a lot of young people saying, this is what you have to take seriously. This is how this affects us. And compelling that expansion of dialogue to go beyond just the states and beyond the kind of more powerful states to say, let's have this conversation properly.
So inclusion and diversity, but like in the American context, DEI has kind of a bad name at this point because it's so instrumentalized and box checky and superficial, diversity, equity, and inclusion. But if you're practicing inclusion in a serious way and diversity in a serious way, then maybe you're more likely to cultivate empathy. It sounds like an organizational culture thing is decisive here. I mean, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. Who is around your table? Who is missing? And those who are missing, pull up a chair and invite them to join. Kind of, we need to have a bigger conversation. We need to get more people involved and understand a more nuanced idea of security, which kind of goes to my project right now. We seem to have quite a dominant idea of what security is, but what does that look like to different people? How do they experience security?
That's interesting. I do, one of my strands of research is on progressive foreign policy and progressive grand strategy. And one of the cleavages between left progressives in the US and like liberals or liberal internationalists is precisely this question of like, what is security? How they view it? How expansively? And also like, for whom and against whom and at whose expense? And like, those are foregrounded questions in the progressive worldview. In the liberal internationalist worldview, those questions literally don't exist. They're just not in the imagination. Like the everything is oriented toward the state and the state provides for society kind of thing. I don't have a question there, but.
I think it sounds like we'd have so much more to unpack in a longer conversation about these ideas.
Yeah. It's a shame that we're on opposite sides of the planet. there's some literature arguing that empathy can be, I'm aware of this literature, but I haven't read the literature directly. But it says that like empathy can be bad and compassion is what social life requires. And I'm acutely aware of critiques of neoliberal and like power-based ways of instrumentalizing empathy. And you have a whole section of the essay where you talk about, I don't know what you call it, like challenges or difficulties incorporating empathy mm-hmm. into strategy. What are some of those like hiccups or problems?
Yeah, so one of the most popular books in recent years has probably been Paul Bloom's Against Empathy. Yeah. And he argues in favor of rational compassion. And he's got a number of different arguments. The one I think is striking is that empathy can distort your priorities, because empathy is often rooted to very compelling emotional stories, which means you prioritize certain elements or certain people over others. And also another challenge with it is that empathy can create very strong in-groups, because you connect with people and say, I understand you, I see you, I hear you, you matter to me. And the reason that you're having problems is because of this out-group. And so empathy can be used as a tool to exacerbate some of those tensions between in-groups and out-groups. And this is something that other people have written about as well. Naomi Head's got a great article about the costs of empathy and the ways in which it's not something that's very easy, that it has political costs, it has embodied costs, it has psychological costs. So there's some really interesting work out there on some of these challenges. And I think it's one of those concepts that is never going to be perfect. It's never going to give all the answers. And it's really important that we're aware of how it can be misused. Like you mentioned with neoliberalism, there are people who write about the ways in which it can be a tool to, again, further exacerbate asymmetries of power. Because you empathize with people, it can be seen as a form of condescension or a patronizing attribute to other people without actually that, again, reflection and ability to change the systems or the structures of power. So knowing these nuances and knowing that they're part of the concept, but that the concept has many meanings, just like power does.
Yeah. Understanding the concept of empathy is important, or like embracing it, but it doesn't buy you out. Like if you claim to practice empathy, it doesn't buy you out of like questioning the larger purpose of your strategy. When I teach strategy, I don't focus much on the vision or role conception that gives meaning to strategy. But it's very obviously true that if empathy is instrumentalized in a strategy meant to preserve a particular distribution of power or a particular status quo, which is the knock against DEI in a lot of American contexts, like, well, it's obviously going to be used to perpetuate all the injustices and evils and problems that go along with that status quo, you know? And so I guess, yeah, I suppose that's limiting. I don't know if there's a question there. It struck me that the Bloom guy, the one that you mentioned about, he's arguing for rational compassion. Way he's talking, I don't know if you agree with this, but like it sounds like the way he's talking about empathy as creating like strong reinforcing in groups, and that's a problem. That is a rephrasing of saying a lack of empathy for out groups. No, I mean, like if you have empathy, it shouldn't be hived off.
Yeah, and that's the thing, and it's again goes to some of those questions: empathy for whom, empathy for what, empathy to what ends, which I think are really important. And it goes to that final section of my article where what I suggest is that we have a more expansive idea of empathy, which is really that to use empathy truly strategically would be to look at how do we use it as a way to expand our areas of concern and expand the capacity for cooperation. And that isn't meant to be naive. I'm aware it does sound quite idealistic and naive, but given the scale of the challenges that we face in the international arena and in international security, we need to find collective approaches to some of these challenges. And empathy is a way of being able to listen to how different people see those challenges and finding ways to navigate through them, which is not easy at all. It's uncomfortable. It challenges our ways of thinking, and it's never going to be perfect.
Yeah, I don't know if this phrasing is correct, but it strikes me that if you're practicing empathy in a serious way, there will be instrumental consequences, but practicing it is not instrumental. It's like processual or in you know, accumulative or something.
I wonder if you can I wonder if you can ever fully strip out the instrumental part from it, because it's empathy for what, even if you're using it to design strategy, that it's going to encounter politics. Mm-hmm. So it might mediate the worst excesses of your strategy and your objectives. It might mean that you recognize there's a need for more concessions or more compromise than perhaps you'd originally envisioned if you went with solely a unilateral kind of zero-sum approach to strategy. But it will never be totally compassionate, I guess. Maybe that's where it comes upon compassion and empathy. You know, it's not about creating kind strategy necessarily, though there's an argument that that could be incorporated in.
Yeah, I mean, there's an enlightened form of rationality, I think, that some of us strive toward, where it's like, whatever our motive for doing the thing is instrumental. I mean, there's, you're not going to escape the desire to like impact the world or change things or whatever. But we all recognize, or not we all, we wish all would recognize that, like, in order to have what you really seek, as long as it's, you know, not world domination or something, it's possible to have an enlightened rationality, a larger sense of self, and it's desirable. And the question is just like, well, how do you get there? And it's not about pushing the empathy button. It's about a kind of transformation, and not just of the self. Like, neoliberalism went wrong by forcing us all to look inward and blaming ourselves or attributing things to ourselves. And like, so it's difficult because you're trying to, it's this concept that resonates most loudly on the individual level, but it cannot remain there, seems like an issue. Yeah, and like the real potential is kind of in being able to like transform how we view a problem, maybe, and like what we view as problems in a sense.
Yeah, exactly. And I do think that philosophers have been tying themselves in knots about, you know, is there ever a truly good deed? Is there ever, kindness?
Yeah.
But, but this is why it's helpful to think about empathy as a practice and a mindset, because it should encourage you to adapt and to iterate when you learn something new. So if you're like, oh, actually, I tried it this way and it's having a detrimental impact, how do we change this? Mm-hmm. Is it beneficial to change this?
I mean, in the most rational sense, it seems like practicing empathy in a real way could resolve collective action problems. And if you're coming at it with like, well, we're going to resolve our collective action problems, and so we're going to press the empathy button, like, obviously it's not, you're going to go wrong somehow. But conceptually, like in the abstract, I can see how that would be like a real tangible resolution of a rational dilemma, a security dilemma.
No, I think it's a good way of managing complexity, just accepting that you don't know everything, that there are very different ways of looking at a problem, and that there are many moving parts all the time.
That's interesting. Yeah. Because complexity is like the buzzword of our times. In part as a catch-all for like the feeling of overwhelm, and like everything is genuinely complex. So that may be like a way of like navigating. That's interesting. I have one big final question that might be like very hard to answer. I don't know. Do you have thoughts about how to cultivate empathy as a practice in statecraft? Is that what the EU-funded project is ultimately driving toward? Do you have answers?
Yeah. And I accept that probably in there are my own political assumptions, which are probably very difficult to detach from it. But I think cultivating empathy as a practice in statecraft requires much greater investment in diplomacy. Sending people out to really get to know different countries, different people, to build relations. Again, I think it's about dialogue and the importance of dialogue, even if you disagree, even if you are in tension, you have to have lines of communication somewhere. It doesn't have to be that the whole country knows it. It can be back channel. You have to have dialogue, exchange in a public level, facilitating ways of and means of having people to people exchange, or cultural, technological, scientific exchanges. Encouraging people to learn languages, because I think you do get a different mindset when you have access to a different language, when you really have access and you can engage with people and understand the cultural references and the subtle meanings of another language. I think that's really key. Patience, encouraging people to not need the answers immediately and to know that they're going to change and that you have to adapt. And also, I think this critical one is investing time and effort in building relationships with various different people, with various stakeholders, with your foreign counterparts, with non-governmental organizations, with members of civil society, trying to expand that dialogue and build relationships so you can build trust. So then you get far more trusted, credible, critical voices giving you different perspectives, giving you access to both communicate policies of the state, but also to give you new sources of input and diverse perspectives that can feed into the data available to people at the heart of statecraft.
Good answers. Yeah.
I'm afraid we're always so long. I like complexity, and I find that this is not as simple.
So good. That's actually great for the podcast format. Yeah. Yeah. Thick and, yeah. I mean, a lot of that, a lot of what you just described comes from or has the consequence of thickening ties with the other or with what would otherwise be an outgroup, creating closer connections in some way. Okay. Well, this has been great. I appreciate you coming on. Thank you for your time. Yeah. I never know how to wrap these things up. This has been, I've enjoyed this tremendously. I hope we can talk again sometime. Good luck with your research.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to join you.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good night.
Thank you.
All right.